This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Jessica Crichton. Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast. We're paying tribute to singer, actress and activist Olivia Newton-John, who has passed away aged 73. There have been so many lovely memories and stories shared about Olivia from family, friends and colleagues as well. And I'm sure that many of you listening will have your own favourite song or film of hers that really touched you. Let us know. We're on WhatsApp now, so you can send us voice notes, pictures, even videos as well. Save this number to your phone, 03700 100 444. That's 03700 100 444. Data charges may apply. You can still text us as well as normal, 84844. Texts are charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour. We'll be discussing one of Olivia's most iconic moments on screen. Yes, that scene in Greece where her character Sandy transforms her image and we see her for the first time in those tight black trousers. Why is that scene still being talked about more than 40 years later? We'll be hearing from another one of the stars in that movie, Stockard Channing, who played Rizzo, who'll be joining us to pay tribute to her co-star. Also this morning, one of Britain's most distinctive voices will be with me in the studio. Heather Small has released her first album in 16 years. The former M People singer will be talking about why she's remixed all of her classic songs alongside an orchestra, and how she went from shyness as a child to performing in front of thousands of people. Plus, living day to day with a chronic and invisible illness, two women share their experiences and how it's impacted their lives. Find out why one woman describes her bed as her biggest comfort, but also her worst enemy. We'll also have the final episode of our series on abortion, where a woman we're calling Kerry recalls her experience whilst in an unhappy relationship. But first this morning, as I mentioned, British-born actor and singer Olivia Newton-John has died at the age of 73. She's best remembered for playing that iconic role of Sandy in the musical film Grease. And possibly the scene she's best remembered for is when she transforms from the girl next door into Teen Rebel. Still sounds so good, doesn't it? Olivia Newton-John joined us on Woman's Hour a number of times over the years, talking about her career and also her charity work. And in 2012, during an interview with Jenny Murray, she talked about those trousers. Yes, the black skin-tight pants she wore in that iconic scene.
Every day, somewhere in the world, wherever I am, someone will ask me about the movie, or they love it, or their kids do, or their grandkids do, and I just came back from a big tour of Asia, and the question, they said, where's John Travolta? Like he was an appendage and we were always together. So it's really amazing that, you know, the world still thinks of me like that. And it's all right now, but in 20 years it's going to be really weird. Kids will be looking at me like, what?
They're going to expect you to have your shoulders bone, very, very tight pants, which I suspect you would still fit into, actually.
Well, I wouldn't want to try them on now, but I still have them.
Well, I'm joined now by the film critic Karen Krasanovich to talk about the enduring appeal of Grease and its story of teenage sexual awakening in 1950s America, and also by Olivia Moore, who is currently playing Sandy in the stage version of Grease in London's West End. Very good morning to you both. Thank you for coming on to Woman's Hour. Olivia, I'd just like to start with you because I understand that you had to actually break the news of Olivia Newton-John's death during the performance of Grease last night.
Yes, so I found out the news in the interval. So we went into Act Two, we did the show as normal, and then at the end I read out a statement informing the news of her passing, which was so surreal. And you could tell by the audience members, a lot of them didn't know the news. So it was a really sad moment, but also slightly heartwarming because the initial reaction from audience members, you could just tell how loved she was and is. So yeah, it was a very surreal moment, but one to really a beautiful moment to be a part of as well.
Yeah. And then you then had to sing Hopelessly Devoted to You, didn't you, after breaking that news?
Yeah, so it's the first thing I do in Act Two. And yeah, after knowing that news, it's always such a special song to sing. But I think after hearing what has happened, it made it so much more powerful. It was very emotional. And yeah, a lot of pressure as well, because that show and the rest of the run will be absolutely dedicated to her. So I put pressure on myself to make sure that it was perfect for her. it's a moment that will stay with me.
Now, Karen, one of the most popular scenes that people associate with Olivia Newton-John is, of course, as I mentioned, when she appears in Grease in that killer outfit. Why is that so popular? Why is that image so memorable?
Well, number one, she looks amazing, and it's an iconic image. It's one that hasn't really become kitsch, or you know, we haven't decried it in the decades that since the movie's come out. But also, I think it's for Sandy the character, it's a transformation into something more, sexy and sexual, but not abandoning her original character. So she just decides to take a different angle of her own personality, but it's still playful, it's still light, and it's still somehow genuine. So I think that that's one of the reasons why we love this particular scene. And also, she looks amazing.
She does, even still now. And Olivia, how does that scene translate in the theatre? What's it like playing that scene and putting on such tight trousers?
It's amazing. I feel amazing when I come out. And I think as well, we kind of wanted to, with this production, we really wanted to show a different kind of angle. I think everyone kind of sees in the film her put on this really sexy outfit, and somehow then she's kind of, you know, people's opinions of her change. And as Karen said, it's a different angle. You know, she's still this warmth in her character, this cheekiness is still completely within that last section. It's just, I think it's that confidence and that kind of, I think, self-respect for herself as well. You know, she's gone on such a journey. She's really, you know, she's had a lot of conflict with a lot of characters. And I think at that point, she's so defined in who she is, and she's so strong and confident in it, that it's like, yeah, put those tight trousers on, girl, and you strut right out. Because honestly, doing it every night, you feel so great and you feel so strong. And I think that is the message that we wanted in our production, for female empowerment. And that moment really, really does emphasise that.
Karen, that's interesting, isn't it? Olivia saying there that it's a message of female empowerment. Is that how it's kind of considered within the film space? Do you feel as though that transformation might have been for her to get the guy? Or is there another way of looking at this?
I mean, Olivia's got it completely right. It's this moment of confidence where she knows her own power, but it doesn't need to be heavy-handed. It can still be playful and reach out and be welcoming. So in the film world, I think it's considered not only one of the great moments in transformation, and there are many in throughout cinema history. But I think people see it, okay, number one is a visual. Number two, ostensibly she does it to get the guy. But really the reason why it lasts is because we get to see her allowing herself to be, just to look different, to be different, to have a different approach, but to still be her. And I think that that's very rare. You hardly see that in a lot of scripts where something is done for a particular purpose.
Now, the other iconic woman in that film, Grease, is Rizzo, played by Stockard Channing. And Stockard joins me now. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for coming on. And it's such a sad time for you, because obviously you got to know Olivia Newton-John very well during that production, didn't you?
Yes. Hi. Good morning. I have to say it was an enormous shock last night when I heard the news. I'd been out to dinner and I came back and I'd left my phone and there were these messages. So it was a great bolt from the blue and also brought everything back. And when you speak of that scene, I remember very clearly, first of all, it was what the whole film wasn't really shot in sequence, but that was part of the last sequence, that whole last number, you know, with outside this is the carnival and all that brilliant hot LA sunshine. And I do remember that none of us had ever seen what was she was going to come out. And she came out of her trailer in sort of a big sort of terry cloth bathrobe. And obviously you could see the hair was totally different, the makeup. But when she took off that robe, everyone, all of us in the company were just beside ourselves because of the transformation was so amazing. And obviously we rehearsed the scene. We saw it several times. But because they showed clips of it last night on the news and I was watching it, I was reminded, if you look at all the guys, the boys' faces when they were around her in the number, they're like, oh my God, oh my God. And I think they all were genuinely shocked. And John has this, John looks like a little boy confronted with a woman. That's what I felt watching it. And I totally agree that it was a moment of empowerment. And also, you know, it was kind of massively exciting as we were all standing there dripping in the sunshine and exhausted. It was really fun, you know. And then, of course, we did it over and over again and all of that. And we got used to it. But I think that initial reaction we all had to her.
Yeah. Interesting that you all had the same reaction as we had when we first saw that scene.
Yeah. And I think she had a lot of fun with it. She loved it.
She really did enjoy it. How was it for you on set playing, I suppose, the bad girl to Sandy's good girl image?
I think I was probably playing the girl who was, I don't know if it's a bad girl. If you want to talk about empowerment, she was definitely someone who enjoyed sex and was out there and probably was quite threatened, you know, the new girl, the Australian from another, you know, all of that, and threatening her power and her little clique of pink ladies and all of that. I mean, as I remember, it's quite a while ago. But yeah, I think they were just kind of, I think at the end, at the very end of the film, there's this revelation that Rizzo is not pregnant, which if you throw your mind back, if you were alive then, in those days, it was no joke. And it isn't a joke today if you were pregnant as a teenager. And so it was for Rizzo at the very end. To me, she became a kid again. She was like a relieved teenager, you know. She'd avoided this. So there's a lot of joy, the whole ending of that moment, you know, with that wonderful fanciful thing where she and John get in this car and float up to the sky. I think they all that conflict or resentment or threat was totally put aside at the end. And I think that was one of the genius moments of the film, that it went out on such a lovely, lifting, positive note.
Are you surprised at how it stood the test of time, how Grease is still popular to this day?
I have been, but as I've said before, a lot of it has to do with technology, because when it came out, it was very popular, made a lot of money and all of that. But then, you know, the tapes of VCR bits and all of that, we can all remember those. And so the fact that people could see it over and over again in their homes, and I still to this day, people, young women, you know, who saw it with their grandmothers. I mean, really, you know, amazing, and what it meant to them. And that's, so they didn't have to, some people do go out to the theater and, you know, see it in the movie theater. But for a lot of people, it was part of their domestic life.
Yeah. And What would be your enduring memories of Olivia then, and working for her over that summer in 1978?
Well, it was, well, first of all, it was summer. You know, it was summer. A lot of stuff was shot outside. I remember the dance sequences in the gym, and it was hot. It was steaming, and we were also thrown in it together. And I was always struck by her warmth, her sunniness. And I did say, she was like summer. She had warmth and grace and this sunniness about her, which was genuine, as far as I could tell. You know, I mean, I think we all felt that way about her.
Yeah, we've had some people getting in contact about this because, as you say, she was loved by so many. Someone has WhatsApped us to say, I remember watching Olivia Newton-John in Greece when I was not even 10 years old. It was the first time I got swept up in a love story and fell in love with the film. It just seems like this is a type of film, and that scene in particular is a type of scene that took people's attention no matter what age they were, Stockard.
Yeah, it was great, and the song is great. I mean, it's a perfect balance of a little bit of humor, but also she has a look on her face like, you know, screw you to John, which is, you know, because he broke her heart, and now she is sort of getting her own back, and you can see him just entranced by the whole thing. I think that's what was mentioned earlier. And, you know, I said, seeing that clip last night reminded me of it all, and it was a really, you know, joyful and hardworking and consumptive time, and we all became a real company over those months. And it was months; it was like 3 months, I think.
And Karen, how rare is it for someone's character to stand the test of time in this way, particularly a female character?
Well, it's when you're genuine, and from what Stockard said, she was. Olivia's character meshed with the character she was playing. And I think that that's when we really see performance that's indelible, that really lasts. And also getting the balance right with the script and the casting and the costume. Let's give...
Robert Waldsky.
Yes, with the 1950s vintage shark skin trousers, from what I understand.
Oh, my goodness. What are you noticing, Olivia, about the types of audiences coming to watch?
Yeah, it all comes together anyway. That's what I meant to say. I think that's what makes a memory, but it's great to remember Olivia this way, and it's wonderful to hear that she was really like that.
And still popular, Olivia, from when you're on stage and you're noticing that the people that you're performing to, the audience, what kinds of people are coming in? It seems like a range of people have been touched by what Olivia Newton-John did.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got, you know, you've got different generations, people that were there when the movie came out, you know, they're bringing their grandchildren and friends are coming, and, you know, it really is open to everyone. And it's so amazing to see, because I remember when I first watched the film, and I always say this, but it was my only CD that I had where I had the lyrics book in the cover. And I would take it out and it got so tatty. Like, I had this really small bit of sellotape that was just desperately trying to hold the book together. But I remember it was the first time that I had felt that freedom of expression and singing and dancing in my room. And I think that's what audiences feel. They, you know, they, unfortunately, they're in a theatre, so they do have to sit down. But I can see that everyone wants to get up and dance. You can't help but feel joyful when you watch it. And I think, you know, I think with a show, a story like Grease, so many people can relate to so many different characters. And I think that's why people cling on to it, because they see themselves in it, whether it's Sandy, whether it's Rizzo, whether it's Danny, you know. And I think that's why so many people can relate. And that's why it's, you know, it's really so loved. I absolutely love doing it.
Really is. Thank you all for sharing your experiences and paying tribute this morning. Stockard Channing, Karen Krasanovich and Olivia Moore paying tribute to Olivia Newton-John, who has passed away at the age of 73. Now, after leading England women to Euros victory, the captain of the Lionesses, Leah Williamson, will be the captain of Women's Hour for a very special programme this coming Thursday. Leah will be joining me for an exclusive chat, talking about some of the issues close to her heart. Some of them might even just surprise you. But we also want to hear from you as well. Do you have a future Lioness who would like to ask Leah a question? You can ask her about her pre-match rituals, or maybe her favourite song to get ready to for a game, or maybe what it's like growing up as an Arsenal player when your dad supports Spurs. We're on WhatsApp, so you can send us a voice note. The number is 03700 100 444. You can text us or tweet us too, but it would be really good if we could hear your voices. So send in those voice notes. That number again is 03700 100 444. Do remember, though, that data charges may apply. Now, as you know, we always want to hear your stories on Women's Hour, talk about the things that don't get talked about elsewhere. In 2019, we asked you, have you had an abortion? How did you feel about it then? And how do you feel about it now? Well, the response was huge. It was powerful and varied. And what became clear was that there were lots of women who have had abortions and feel unable to talk about it. Since Roe versus Wade was overturned in June in the United States, more women are telling their stories, but secrecy and shame still surrounds abortion. These stories from you, our listeners, were first broadcast in 2019, and the terminology might have changed a bit, but the issues are more relevant than ever. In the last of the series, we hear from a woman we're calling Kerry, who had an abortion 13 years ago when she was in an unhappy relationship. She told our reporter Henrietta Harrison how she found out she was pregnant.
It was in early January, so I just turned 18. So maybe a week after I turned 18, I realised that I was late. I was maybe only a couple of weeks late, but I remember feeling very different in my body, which sounds like very like stereotypical, but I felt nauseous. I felt my boobs were incredibly sore, just symptoms that I'd never had before with a period, or a way I'd never felt in general. My first thought that came to mind was that I'd had like quite a bad food poisoning a couple of weeks previously, and I was on the pill, but we weren't using any other contraception. And then I think when I did the test, that's when I realised, okay, yeah, that's probably, I've taken the pill, I've had a poorly stomach, and it's probably had the same effect as it would do if you were sick, but obviously in your mind you don't make that same connection.
So you had this sense that you were pregnant. When was that confirmed?
I walked home via the shops and I picked up a pregnancy test, and I remember going into the toilet. No one was in the house, so my mum and dad were out, my sisters were at school, and I stood in the kitchen waiting for the test to like develop, and in my other hand I had the telephone ready to call the doctors, because I felt so certain, number one, that I was pregnant, and number two, that if I were pregnant, the first thing I was going to do was call the doctors and get an abortion. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that that was exactly what was going to happen.
You were young. You were a girl sort of just becoming an adult, really. What were your feelings then?
I was distressed that the situation had arisen, but I wasn't distressed about the element of choice. Like, I felt very, very sure about that. That wasn't anything that I felt kind of conflicted about. So I felt kind of very strong, which, like, looking back now, a decade later, I'm kind of amazed that I'm not going to say I felt, like, weak or afraid or anything like that. I felt very strong. I felt very determined. I was on my own with this, but I had everything I needed within me to handle it.
You found out you were pregnant with the phone in your hand. Yes. So just tell me what happened next.
Yeah. I kind of carried on as normal then. I obviously didn't tell anybody in my family. I didn't tell the father of the child. I didn't tell anybody what happened.
Because?
I just felt that I didn't want anybody else's opinion on this. I knew what I wanted, and I felt like I knew how other people would handle it. The person that I was in a relationship with at the time, I felt was particularly manipulative.
It felt like it was your decision to make.
Yeah, and I didn't want to conflate that with other people's ideas. I didn't want to feel like I was going to be made to feel bad for not being uncertain.
So what happened? You'd called the doctor. Mm-hmm. How did the procedure come about?
Yeah, so I went for the first appointment at my local hospital. So I went there. I was interviewed. I say interviewed, which says everything really, doesn't it? But the appointment was with a male doctor and a female nurse. And the male doctor was incredibly aggressive with what felt like a line of questioning, you know, around why did I not want the child? How certain was I that I didn't want to have a baby? Had I spoken to anybody else? Why hadn't I spoken to anybody else? Would I consider speaking to somebody else? You know, they seemed to ramp up and they were very fast, and I felt kind of almost out of breath in my responses. And he kept asking me, how do you feel? How do you feel?
And at this point, I kind of broke down and just said, I feel very sad. But actually, I'm not sure I did feel very sad. I felt very sad at this situation where I kind of felt like I was being almost pursued for deciding not to go ahead with this. In hindsight, I think potentially he was trying to get me to engage and to acknowledge my decision. And perhaps if I'm sat there and I'm kind of a little bit glazed over and I'm not saying specifically how I'm feeling, if I am saying I feel like I'm going to university in 6 months and so I need to focus on that, perhaps what he was trying to get me to do was fully acknowledge the gravity of the decision and to make sure that I knew my own mind enough to make that choice. But on the other hand, like being the adult feminist that I am, I just wonder if perhaps there was an element of him that was uncomfortable with me just saying, I don't feel sad and I don't feel conflicted. I feel certain that this is what I want to do and I don't feel that I'll regret it. I definitely knew what I wanted to do as firmly as when I believe a woman falls pregnant and knows she wants to continue that pregnancy and knows that there is no way she could end it. That is how sure I was.
So you had your appointment, mm-hmm. the interview, as you called it, with the doctor. Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
So then I was given the first tablet, which would begin the process, basically, of like a forced miscarriage.
That happened there and then?
Yeah, there and then I was given the first tablet. So we had the questions. I cried and said that I was felt sad. And then he gave me the first tablet. So it was quite fast, really. And this was on the Thursday. And so I was booked in for the second tablet at a hospital further away for the Saturday morning. So I had 48 hours for that to kind of like kick in, start the process. So I went back home, yeah, and I was working at the time at like a fast food restaurant. So I was in a situation where I was kind of continuing my shifts. I had a Friday night shift and I had a Saturday night shift, which I intended to do after my abortion. I kind of didn't want anybody to know, so I tried to continue as normal as possible. But on the Friday morning, I started to bleed quite heavily. So I think that was like a sign of things happening. It was just basically like a heavy period. It wasn't so much that I was like super concerned, but there was kind of a sense that your body is processing the pill and it's beginning to happen. So that kind of felt oddly reassuring that what I had wanted was already happening, because I had extreme like morning sickness already, which is very strange to me. Like I never thought that you would have symptoms of pregnancy so early on, but like the smell of caffeine, I just could vomit. It was unbelievable. And in the morning I felt very, very sick, which is just strange.
How many weeks pregnant were you?
I think I was about 6 weeks when I had the abortion. Long enough for them to know that I was pregnant and stuff, but still so early on, really, when you think about it.
So you were doing the shift at the fast food restaurant.
Yes.
You started to bleed.
Yeah. I was very upset. I was distressed. I went home early. I don't think I had thought that there would be any kind of physical, because I knew I wasn't going to have an operation, you see. So in my head, this process was going to be a lot like taking the contraceptive pill, you know, something that happened within my body as I went about my everyday life, like a period. So I think that's when I started to realise that it was going to be more than that and that I had to be a bit aware of that.
You went home, you finished the shift. By this point, your partner knew.
Yeah.
What happened then?
When he had rang me and we'd had that conversation, I said to him, I'm going in on Saturday morning, which was the next morning, to a hospital which was in the nearest city. And he said he would come with me. So I didn't argue with him on this. Again, an element of fear that he would come anyway, that he would tell my family. And I think maybe a sense as well that I was still, as you are when you're in an abusive relationship, hoping that there was going to be a time when things would change. Potentially this would be the time that he showed himself to be genuinely caring. It's that kind of the duality of being in a relationship with someone that is really quite harmful to you, where you, on the one hand, know that they are not good for you and want to get away from that, and on the other hand, feel that you deserve that behaviour and therefore you need to try and change so that they will change. So he came with me on the Saturday morning and I can remember trying to scrape together the money for the bus fare to get to the hospital and thinking to myself, for the first time in my life, of women in countries where they could not easily access abortion, that if I were in a situation where I was struggling to make that money, how would I have handled things? To this day, I feel certain that there's nothing I wouldn't have done to make that happen, like stealing money, like anything I would have had to have done to make that happen, I would have. So I remember feeling immensely lucky that this was even an option for me. So we got the bus in really early. I told my parents that I had a training day for the job that I worked at. And luckily they didn't ask me any other questions, which was good. They gave me the second pill and I was with maybe 7 or 8 other women. We were all sat in a circle. There were like little curtains between us, but it wasn't separate rooms. It was like one room. You could kind of see people if you leant back in your chair. Everybody seemed, which is probably what they would say about me, very together. We went in about 6 a.m. We had to be in very, very early. And they said we would all be gone by midday. At midday, everybody had left. I was still there. The second tablet was just not working. They asked me to run up and down stairs and do star jumps, move around to try and like help basically bring on the miscarriage. I remember thinking it was almost like comical, like kind of black humour of me being in this stressful situation at such a young age with someone who was in my mind so horrible.
Doing star jumps,
like running up the stairs like Rocky, just waiting for something to happen. But obviously I was feeling increasingly anxious about the fact that I was supposed to be at this place for a certain amount of time. My parents were now aware that I was not home when I was supposed to be home, and I was supposed to still be on shift that evening. So all these things were just kind of... So it got to maybe 4 p.m. and they took me in and just said, we're going to basically try and examine you now to see where you're at with this, because your body is not reacting the way it would normally. And they basically had to forcibly take the fetus out of my body. The invasiveness of it, I wasn't expecting. When you go for surgery, perhaps you know that that's going to be happening. And I'm at such a young age, that's never happened to me before. I've never had a smear test, you know. At this point, I'd slept with 2 men in my life. So it's more kind of invasiveness than I was prepared for. And when the nurse took the fetus out, she put it in like a little dish and said to me, would you like to look at it? And I just remember thinking, that's such a bizarre question for me right now. And I said, no, I would not like to do that. Almost again, like someone's trying to get me to feel very, very upset. And I still don't know to this day how much of that is genuine concern, that is this person really aware of what's happening? You know, does she know that she's ending the possibility of life? And does she know that now, obviously, that it's been carried out, that the fetus is gone? You know, are they trying to tell me that? Or are they trying to constantly say to me, you should feel sad, you should feel sad? I felt just very overwhelmed by that. But I did feel immensely relieved when I knew that that was over. I had the pressure of everybody wanting to know where I was. My boss wanted to know why I hadn't come in for my shift. My mum wanted to know where I was. I actually messaged my boss and said to her I wouldn't be in because I was in hospital. And bearing in mind I was 18 at this time, she rang my mother and told her, said she's in hospital and she won't be in today. So that was, I mean, probably illegal, because she can't, when I'm over the age of 18, disclose that kind of information to my parents. But that then meant that my mum and my stepdad were aware of the fact that I had said that. So I kind of got back to my hometown that evening, and oh, the whole family are, you know, waiting for me, wanting to know what happened. So I'm at this point where I've had such a long, emotionally overwhelming day, and I now have to deal with all of this.
So there's one here of my mum when she was pregnant with me.
It's cute, isn't it? Yeah, so that's the first picture of me that's in there, which is me when I was in the belly.
So how old was your mum there then?
19. Yeah, very, very young. But there we are.
But did you think, when you were deciding to have your abortion at 18, were you actually then thinking about your mum at 19? Or was that a connection you made later?
No, I made that connection at that time. I felt that history was repeating itself. When my mum had me, she was 19. She hadn't been with her, my biological father, very long. And he was very tempestuous. He, you know, violence, gambling, drinking. He's not in my life anymore. But I could see history repeating itself, definitely. You know, I could see myself in a relationship with someone who was almost a mirror image of the biological father that I'd never grown up with, but everything that I had heard about him from my family and from his family was there. Had I been in a similar way to my mother was tied to my father, had I been tied to this guy forever, I don't think I would have ever felt totally free.
Obviously, pro-life campaigners would say that the unborn child has rights. I mean, do you have any sense that you ended a life?
No, I think I ended the possibility of life. That's how I felt. There was the possibility that something was going to happen, but it didn't. I think you just have to prioritise the life that is here, that is established and that is right in front of you.
The reporter there was Henrietta Harrison. All of those stories in the series are available right now on BBC Sounds, and we'll also tweet out a link to an article about the series. I have to say thanks to everyone for getting in touch. I did ask you about your memories of Olivia Newton-John, who has passed away. And Julia has messaged in to say, RIP, beautiful Olivia. I remember her as a young woman, and these memories comfort me with the strange, with the strange fact that I'm over 70. Olivia, a little bit of my youth has gone with you. RIP. Also, we've had someone WhatsApp in to say I was at university at the time and we all rushed out to try and buy the pants that we obviously saw in Greece. Being late 70s and pre-internet, shops were all we had. I couldn't get black, but I got a gold pair and still have them, although I doubt they would fit now. Thank you, Jacqueline, for that message. Do continue to get in touch with us. You can WhatsApp us, as I mentioned, 03 700 100 444, or the text number is 84844. And speaking about people getting in touch, Listeners Week is coming up. There's still a few slots left. Maybe you're starting a career, moving your life in a new direction, navigating a complicated relationship, or perhaps you care passionately about a particular social issue. If so, let us know. You can get in touch via our website at bbc.co.uk/womanshour, or you can WhatsApp or text. And on social media, it's at BBC Woman's Hour. Now, what's it like to live with a chronic but hidden illness? Well, that's the experience of our next two guests. Poppy Nash is a textile artist drawing on a long tradition of female storytelling through textiles. Poppy lives with type 1 diabetes, and one of her latest works is The Art of Dying 2.0. It's a full-scale installation of bedclothes and bedding, examining the experience of living in isolation as a vulnerable person through the pandemic. Also, Ione Gamble lives with Crohn's disease. She's the founder and editor of the art, fashion and culture publication Polyester, and has now written a book, Poor Little Sick Girls. Both of them are with me this morning. Good morning to you both. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. I'm very well. Ione, I'd like to start with you, because when you were first diagnosed with Crohn's disease, how did your life change?
I was diagnosed when I was 19, so it was a time of change anyway. I was in my second term of university and I was kind of rushed into hospital to begin treatment because it had gotten quite severe by that point. And it was kind of just like this total realignment of what my life might look like. It felt like this big thing that I couldn't quite yet comprehend. And also, I just didn't even know chronic illness was a thing. Like, awareness was much worse. And at that point, I thought your condition would either be terminal or you'd get better. There wasn't really much like conversation around this in between phase. So I would describe it as this real kind of like realignment of expectations of what I could do. But not in a negative way. Like, I think it really did give me the motivation to do whatever I wanted, to not make the best of it, but to be confident and to do all of the things I wanted to do, because I wasn't going to kind of like sink into this condition I was given, if that makes sense.
Okay. And for you, Poppy, your type 1 diabetes diagnosis was much earlier in life, wasn't it?
Hi both. So I was diagnosed when I was 6, which is pretty small and young. But prior to that, I kind of had quite a lot of health issues. I spent a lot of time in hospital before that. But I think it's interesting that you've got us both here, like Ione being diagnosed like teenager and me being diagnosed as child, because I feel very much like when I was diagnosed, it was kind of, the weight wasn't really on my shoulders. It was kind of like on my family, like my mum mainly, kind of. So then I had, although I was diabetic that whole time, and the medication was like so different back then, about, because that was like 25 years ago. And then kind of I had my own like re-diagnosis, reawakening kind of moment when I was about 19 as well, being like, oh, right, this is the thing that I have to deal with forever now, like as an adult, and like seeing actually how it did impact me and how my life and my body was basically different to like my friends and other people.
Yeah. So give us an idea of what it is like day to day when you're living and managing a chronic condition.
Well, it's just constant all the time. But I think it's also funny how you can kind of like, I think people's resilience is like really powerful and you kind of get used to things, like even like having hypos, which is like a low sugar. It's really intense, like wacky thing to happen to your body, but you kind of get used to them. And like, yeah, you just got to deal with loads of things. But one of the other things that I think is interesting is like when you're diagnosed, you think, oh, I've got this health condition or this disability or chronic illness or whatever you want to call it. And then there's like this much larger circle of things that also are now part of your life. So it's like the healthcare system. It's like the way that society treats you or like all these other things, like even getting prescriptions and stuff. So it's yes, you have the chronic illness, which affects your body and how you feel. But then it's also like this big life shift of like how you basically arrange yourself in society.
Yeah. And Ione, you're sitting across from me in the studio, nodding your head along to that. And one of the things that you wrote in the book there was about internalized ableism. And you said in the book that that ensured I never spoke more than a whisper about what I was going through. So you can relate to what Poppy's saying there.
Yeah, I think it kind of has boomeranged for me a lot. So when I was first diagnosed, I hadn't experienced ableism, obviously. I hadn't like had it in my life in a secondhand sense either. So I was kind of very upfront trying to just say it how it was to everyone. I'm quite like a outspoken person anyway, I suppose. And then I was getting these reactions from people that were less than ideal, that were kind of like maybe even fear, or like I could just sense people pulling away from me as well, or people actively did. So then I became a lot quieter about it. And then I entered kind of like the world of work as like a graduate and realized that people with chronic illnesses and disabilities are just absolutely not tolerated in like structured workplaces. And I found it very difficult to kind of assimilate into that environment as someone with chronic fatigue and like other symptoms. So that's when I kind of felt at my most kind of quiet and that I couldn't really be loud about this. And I kept it out of like my work, all of these things. And it's only really now with this book and like a few articles that I've written that I am talking about it. But I think it's really important too, because so many of us live with these conditions that feel like they can't say anything and that don't have their workplaces accommodated for them, don't have like friends or family that understand, when really like chronic illness and disability intersects with like all areas of social justice and we need to consider it as such.
And Poppy, you've also spoken about the fact that the pertinent point that the illness that you're dealing with is invisible. And how does that come into play? I mean, are there benefits to it not being seen by people in the wider world?
Well, I think kind of harking back to what Ernest said as well, like the thing is you can't see it. And like, I think also with the internalized ableism and just outright ableism, like people have got a big kind of issue with language. So like using the word disabled or disability is like, people kind of do this like very thing, like, oh, they're like a certain group of people or something like this. And then I think people have got more questions, more like skepticism maybe about people who have invisible disabilities or chronic illnesses, that they're not kind of seen in the same way. So like, I think like what I'm saying is like, it's part of identity. So because you can't see it, the way that you can kind of communicate your chronic illness is through conversation or through people who live very, very close to you. So those are the people who are going to understand your illness the best because they see it the most, or unless you buy it a lot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. And
so...
Carry on.
Yeah. So I just think there's like, also there's like you know, there's pros and cons. Like, the pros are also that you don't have to deal with it. Someone can't see it, so they don't give that to you as part of your identity immediately, because it, you know, you can choose, pick and choose when you disclose it or not. And in a lot of times, because of the way our society is built, and also like Iona's saying, in the workplace, it just is, it becomes so much easier sometimes to keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
And there's always like this kind of debate going on where you're like, is this, sometimes I should bring this up? Or then there's also a lot of guilt about kind of making it into a thing.
Yeah, did you find that as well, Ione? How was your support network? What did the people say around you? Was it a help?
Yeah, I think I have a great support network, but I think because of how illness is still so misunderstood by our society, I write in the book about how, you know, advice can often be well-meaning but damaging, and how, you know, at the hospital, for example, nurses might say, oh, you're too young to be here, thinking it as comfort, but really it sends me into a spiral. Or like different things, like friends or whatever, offering different foods that they think will cure my Crohn's disease when obviously it won't. And this is because we don't really have the language to talk about illness, and we're also obsessed with wellness. We're so obsessed with being our optimum selves through health now, and obviously we've come out of a severe, you know, health anxiety inducing phase of the world, so it's understandable. But I think we should kind of try and approach these things with like empathy, not cure, because for a lot of people that's just not possible, and it's about management, and it's about, you know, being happy, not being healthy all the time.
Poppy, tell me about the installation you made during the pandemic, The Art of Dying 2.0.
So that was also came out of the pandemic as being a vulnerable patient. I always like to do my speech quotations with vulnerable. So I started that project with a research residency I was doing at the Wellcome Collection, and kind of looking at the bed and bedding, because I found this manuscript, pre-1500 manuscript called the Ars Moriendi, which actually translates as The Art of Dying. And it had these like beautiful woodcuts of this man lying in bed. And like different chapters had him surrounded by different things. So different demons or different like worldly things or different saints. And I just immediately, like as soon as I saw him, kind of like fell in love with him. Like I just saw him lying in bed, and I just felt so connected to him as an image. And I kind of recreated that book into a bedspread. So it was kind of like the female version of the book. So I reprinted the pages onto the bedspread.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic came. So the next thing that happened was, it was kind of like the entrapment and like loathing and love and refuge and imprisonment of a bed as someone with a chronic illness became like kind of, with The Art of Dying 2.0, the idea and the concept was about like blowing up the bed and basically the entire interior space of the flat in which I was shielding, soft shielding,
yeah,
became all the same ideas as the entrapment of just the bed in daily life.
It sounds extraordinary, and I've actually seen a picture, and it is just that. Poppy, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us this morning, and thank you as well to Ione Campbell for coming into the studio. Great to hear from you both.
Thank you.
Now, Heather Small has been one of the most distinctive voices in music. She was the voice of Group M People, and they became one of the biggest dance acts in the world, selling tens of millions of albums worldwide. They also won plenty of Brit Awards and a Mercury Award along the way. Heather has now released her first album in 16 years. It's called Colour My Life, teaming up with the London Metropolitan Orchestra, and she's imagined all of her top 10 hits, as well as some new music and some covers as well. If you don't quite remember her name, you'll definitely remember this voice. I'm so excited to have Heather Small with us live in the studio. You saw me nodding my head, shimmying my shoulders along. How are you?
I'm well. And you?
Great. That music, it doesn't matter what kind of day you're having, I find. I listen to your songs with your uplifting lyrics and I just immediately feel better.
Thank you. We try. I think that, you know, music has been such a soundtrack for everyone's lives. And the last few years, it's been very difficult. And we have really leaned on our creatives, from writers to music makers to dancers, to help us through that time. So when I had the opportunity to do this album, I thought to myself, yes, it makes sense, because if I could do it with an orchestra, if I could bring a different flavour, I've been singing them for a long time, but I know that I do certain things live a little bit different, and that I could feel it again, and that it would reinforce the fact that, yeah, I sing and I will always sing, because those two years, but it was difficult.
Oh, very
and you start wondering, you know, can I still sing? Will there be an audience? You know, will people come back out to support us creatives? And I have to say, you know, in lockdown, we supported them, and outside of lockdown, they are now supporting us, and it's been really appreciated.
Well, congratulations, because as you say, it is your first album for 16 years. Mm. Why such a long gap?
I don't know, really. I think if you haven't got anything to say, then you don't say anything. So I and as well, I've become a mother in that time, well, earlier, but my son is now 25. But I always sung and I did a lot of live work, but I also wanted to be at home with my son and see him develop and grow, and also make sure that he develops and grows in the way that I wanted, and that I would always recognise who my son is and he would always recognise who his mother is. I think it's a really, really important job if you take it on. But it's been, I say job, but it's been just the making of me.
Really?
Mm.
Well, there's new tracks as well. As well as all the classics being reimagined, you've written new tracks. How hard was it to go back into songwriting after such a long break?
Do you know, somebody wrote that song for me. Yes, Love
this
Me or Not.
Which is Excited.
Love Me or Not.
Oh, Love Me or Not.
Yeah, Love Me or Not. So that was the new single, the first single. The Excited is the second single, and that is one that has, as you would say, been reimagined with an orchestra. But I didn't write the new songs. But the thing is, writing a song and finding a song, what you have to do is make sure that you own that song. So people did submit things that they thought that would be me. But when I heard this song, I knew that it was written for me. You know, it is uplifting, but it's about self-empowerment and not at the detriment of others. So that's what I'm about. And that's why I still am able to sing those songs with such passion, because they are me, you know, and I've left some of myself in every song. So to go back to them, it's just like picking them up and cuddling them all again and giving them some extra love.
Let's hear...
I'm quite passionate.
I can tell. Your eyes are lighting up as you're telling me this. Okay, let's hear a clip of your new single, Excited. It's the voice, Heather. It's that distinct, iconic voice. I'm assuming that's something you were born with, or have you nurtured it over the years?
I've always had a sound. When I first started, I had a sound, and that's what got me into my first band. But I didn't have any technique, so people liked the sound of my voice. Mm. And at first, I wouldn't go to any vocal coaches, because I didn't want anyone to change the sound of my voice. Yes. So when I really felt embedded in my own sound, then I had some lessons to then bring me up to speed technically. But when you hear Excited and you say the sound, and I think the first Excited, first time around, it's like when a girl of 18 loves you. But, you know, the second time around with Excited, it's like when a woman in her 50s loves you. So it's not that it's not any less, but there's just a bit of bit more richness. It's just a bit more under those. It's just more levels, more layers.
Substance.
Love is love is love. But, you know, a lot of us, who we loved at 18 and who we love at 50, it's changed.
Are you aware then of the kind of impact you're having on people's lives? Because it's multiple generations that are aware of your music now and that are appreciating it.
You know, I'm aware when I do it live. When I've done these festivals, there's been generations, so it's from grandparents to grandchildren come along. And there was one woman, she had her daughter on her shoulders, and the daughter must have been like 8, and she was singing all the songs. And I keep saying, you know, these children have been force-fed. And I'm so happy, because I think to myself, you know, by the time they're 20.
And I mean, so it's not
some live music. I love singing to an audience. So that there's a perpetual audience, it would seem, you know, makes me happy.
And it's not just the fans. You've had quite a few
celebrities and high profile people quoting your songs, even Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Heather.
Yes, although he hasn't got much time in office. I mean, that was quite surreal, it has to be said. Yeah, but what can I say about that? You know, people are left to their own devices. You choose what you want to listen to. And obviously, he's listened to some M people's stuff.
He has.
It hasn't helped him much, though, has it?
Well, no. Discussion, probably a discussion for another time. You were shy as a child.
I was.
Yet you chose to perform in front of thousands of people. Did music help your confidence?
You know what it is? I think that there's lots of people. You know, it's the whole thing. When you talk about like Olivia Newton-John's character, there's layers to you that people don't see. And sometimes you express those layers through creativity. So my layers were expressed vocally. Some people, they put pen to paper. Some people, it's painting. Some people, it's dance. And you show people that there's more to you than they're actually seeing on the surface. And so that was the way that I revealed my personality. But with the shyness, I think as well, I didn't really trust people with my thoughts and ambitions. And sometimes you think you'll be ridiculed, and sometimes you just think you'll be somebody's amusement. And especially if you, like, I always wanted to sing, and my endeavour was really, really true to me. And I didn't want anybody to think that they could put me off my path. And a few people that I did tell, you know, did ridicule me. So I kept my own counsel.
You've had an incredible career. I, for one, have really enjoyed listening to you over the years, and so have so many generations of fans. Thank you so much, Heather Small, for coming into the studio. And I know you'll be performing live on the 18th of September for Radio 2 Live, which would be a fantastic occasion, I'm sure. Thank you so much for coming on to Woman's Hour. Thank you to everyone who listened and got in touch as well. And that's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.